Legal Face-Off on WGNRadio.com is brought to you by McCorkle Litigation Services, leaders in court reporting and legal technology.
Hey, what's up, y'all? It's your man Montel Jordan, and this is how we do it. And right now, you're listening to Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. That's right. You're locked onto the high-energy legal podcast with lawyers Rich Lenkov and Tina Martini, and they're going to be trading jabs on the breaking news and the hottest issues, sports, entertainment, politics. Nothing is off limits. Keep listening, because this is how we do it.
Welcome to another edition of Legal Face-Off on WGN Radio. Of course, we have Tina Martini of McDermott, Will & Emery, and Rich Lenkov from Downey & Lenkov. I'm your moderator, Ryan Burrow. Well, President Joe Biden winds down his presidency, but he's announced he's not in lame duck status quite yet. He's trying to push for Supreme Court reform in his closing months. To talk about that, we're joined by Bertrell Ross, professor of law and director of the Karsh Center for Law and Democracy at University of Virginia. Professor Ross, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So these proposals have been discussed for many years. Biden finally came out, perhaps because he is a lame duck, and proposed what many consider to be unrealistic proposals, but let's go through all three of them. Let's talk about what wasn't in them. The first one is to eliminate immunity for crimes committed while president, of course, in the wake of the Supreme Court decision granting partial immunity to the president for some acts incurred while office. What do you think of that? And basically, what does it mean?
Yeah, I think it's a response to the political moment. A lot of folks were outraged by that decision, and they wanted a response to it. There's a concern about the president being above the law, and the response was a proposed amendment that would put the president or make the president subject to liability for crimes committed while in office. So I'm not surprised by the reaction to it. I think the president recognizes that it would need a constitutional amendment for it to come into law. But it's something that I sort of expected given the political climate of the moment.
Professor, the president also suggested term limits for the Supreme Court, as the U.S. is the only major constitutional democracy that gives lifetime seats to its high court members. What are your thoughts on that?
So this was interesting in terms of it coming up now. So the Biden commission that I served on the Supreme Court studied this issue, among many others, with respect to term limits. And, we provided a pretty broad overview of term limits and the lack of term limits that are applied to the Supreme Court and how that's unique as compared to not only internationally, but also what's occurring within states to not have either term limits or some age limit for nominees or for justices or judges on the court. So I think the term limit proposal is an interesting one because the idea is that it could be something that could be legislated. The idea being that we can impose 18-year term limits on justices, and that would give each presidential term an opportunity to nominate two justices to the Supreme Court, achieve some alignment between the justices on the court and the partisan dynamics, both in the White House or in Congress. But I think that it's a proposal that's difficult to imagine actually passing. Both I question whether it can be something that's passed legislatively. I think that it would require a constitutional amendment. And given the deep polarization over the court right now, I don't see a constitutional amendment being passed imposing term limits. But I do think it's ultimately a good idea.
Just a follow-up question. If that were to be passed, who are the justices who are currently sitting on the court who would be immediately impacted by those term limits?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there'd be three justices that would be immediately impacted that would be, in a sense, termed out of the 18-year term. And those would be Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Alito, Samuel Alito, and Justice Clarence Thomas. So you could see the partisan dimensions of that right there. Those are three Republican-nominated justices. They're considered be on the conservative wing of the Supreme Court. And so proposing something that would immediately X out three of the justices on one side of the partisan divide is obviously going to raise some hackles and create a lot of division over this question.
And the logic, Professor, in favor of term limits is that you don't get a couple things. I mean, number one, when this was put into place, let's face it, life expectancy isn't what it is now. I don't think the framers envisioned people staying on the court for 40 years and presidents using it as a political tool and appointing people who are in their 30s or early 40s simply to have their partisan politics cemented at the highest court for many years.
That's absolutely.
The downside to term limits is that the whole idea is to give these people the freedom to perform jurisprudence free of the, you know, political divide that we're in. But that ignores the fact that the Supreme Court is incredibly politicized right now, right? So that kind of idea, I think, is also antiquated.
Yeah, it's a great point that you're making. Like, does this type of proposal, if it were to be enacted, would that make the court less or more politicized? And there's arguments that it could potentially make the court less politicized based on the idea that we want to avoid the kind of manipulation of the Supreme Court through multiple means. The ones you describe in terms of nominating someone who's very young that could serve on the court for 40 years, 50 years. There's also the concern about strategic retirements in which justices choose to retire when the president of their own party is in office, which can lead to a perpetual partisan imbalance on the court. But then there's on the other side, with respect to term limits, what you're going to have is more of these confirmation hearings, more of these nomination fights, more politics surrounding the Supreme Court. So does that lead to, you know, a push towards even greater politicization of the court? But as you know, it's a very politicized court right now. So, you know, maybe we just have to wrestle with that fact and proceed in a way that we think best accords with Democratic Republican principles.
Yeah, there's been lots of pressure on Justice Sotomayor. It's died down recently, but to retire before the conclusion of the Biden term, it doesn't seem like that's going to happen. So moving on to the third part of this proposal was a binding code of conduct, which would require justices from accepting gifts from certain public political activity and from them or their spouses, or recusing themselves from cases in which them and their spouses are gaining financially. That's obviously gained a lot of attention in the last year or two in the wake of these disclosures involving a couple of the justices, including Clarence Thomas, getting incredibly expensive gifts, property from people who are before the court. So talk to us about that.
Yeah, you know, the court has taken quite a bit of a hit in terms of its integrity and legitimacy in the eyes of the public. It's, you know, polling at a very low level in terms of popularity in the 40s, in terms of popular approval of the court, which is quite troubling. But I think it's very much a response to these ethics concerns that have arisen. You know, there's been plenty of disclosures with respect to Justice Clarence Thomas, with respect to money and gifts and flights and other things of benefit, that things of value that he's received. There's been quite a bit of controversy surrounding Justice Samuel Alito with respect to activities that are perceived as partisan or political, whether it be raising a flag above your home that's associated with a particular interest group or other types of activities. Now, this ethics proposal is a response to this. Now, this is not something new. This is something that's been generated and discussed in Congress. It's also been discussed by the Supreme Court and the Judicial Conference of the court. There's a concern question about who has that, who's best positioned and who has a constitutional authority to regulate the ethics of the court. Members of the court, like including Justice Alito, say that, you know, Congress cannot regulate the ethics of the court. That's for the court to do. But the self-policing of the court, of course, raises concern as to whether there are the right incentives in place for the court to police itself. And then there's Congress that's pushing on the other side for developing a code of ethics that would be applicable to the court. And the question whether that raises separation of powers concerns, whether that is overstepping congressional boundaries in which the court, Congress is regulating the court in ways that the court might say intervenes or impinges on its authority. So those are open questions. I think that this probably has the best chance of moving forward of the three proposals that have been put forth, but it's still very challenging in this deeply partisan environment.
So, Professor, last question. Court packing was another aspect to this conversation that had not been included. Do you want to share your thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? When I joined the commission back in 2021, you know, there was a lot of discussion at that time. This was the beginning of the Biden term, this idea that the president should use his authority and Congress, president aligned with Congress, should use their authority to add the number of seats on the court. You know, I think this has died down a bit lately because I think that people are starting to recognize the potential repercussions of this. You know, the idea is this is a response to the Merrick Garland episode in which his nomination was blockaded by a Republican Senate led by Mitch McConnell. But if you have a president that adds seats to the court from one party, well, then the next president from the other party, if they have a Congress aligned with it, can do the same thing. And so it may not be a solution that responds to the partisan misalignment of the court. It may only do so on the short term, but in the long run, it may not help that much. And so I think that that's part of the explanation for the shift towards a focus on term limits over packing the court.
Professor Ross, thank you so much for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
You are listening to Christina Martini on Legal Faceoff. Dina is a partner at McDermott, Will & Emery and focuses her practice on domestic and international trademark and copyright law, as well as domain name, internet, social media, advertising, and unfair competition law. Dina has received numerous professional accolades, including an AV preeminent rating by Martindale Hubbell and being selected for many years as one of America's leading intellectual property attorneys by various legal publications, including Chambers & Partners and World Trademark Review. Dina is also the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's Women of Achievement Award and has been recognized by Crane Chicago Business as one of Chicago's most influential minority lawyers. In addition to her full-time practice, Dina is an author, columnist, legal analyst, and podcast host, and she frequently shares her thought leadership with respect to current issues and trends impacting both the legal and business landscapes through various media outlets. McDermott, Will & Emery is an integrated international law firm. McDermott has an uncompromising commitment to legal excellence, extraordinary client service, and a high-performance culture. It is committed to helping clients achieve stellar legal and business results today and well into the future. To contact Dina and to learn more about McDermott, Will & Emery, visit MWE.com.
Welcome back to Legal Faceoff with Rich Lenkoff and Dina Martini. I'm Ryan Burrow. Stateville Correctional Center in Crest Hill, Illinois has become a hot topic over poor conditions for inmates. In fact, Heather Lewis Donnell of Lovey & Lovey joins us to talk about that. She represents those inmates in an ongoing class action lawsuit. Thanks for joining us.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
So Heather, as Ryan mentioned, your firm filed a motion for preliminary injunction last month in connection with ongoing litigation, seeking to immediately transfer over 420 people who are currently incarcerated at Stateville due to unsafe conditions at the facility. And the court issued an order last week that prison officials must transfer most who are at Stateville out by September 30. This is part of the ongoing class action lawsuit that your firm's been litigating since 2013. Can you tell us more about the conditions at the prison that led to this case and the latest ruling?
Yes, thank you so much. This ruling, which the court entered last Friday, is a preliminary injunction that is going to make sure that all of our class members, which are the residents of Stateville Correction Center, be transferred and are released if their release date was available, but transferred to other IDOC facilities. There's a small caveat that for some of the class members who reside in the healthcare unit, that's a unit of approximately 34 beds. Last week, there were 17 class members in that unit. I think one one of our class members passed away as well. So from that healthcare unit. So I think, you know, those folks in the healthcare unit will remain for the time being until the rest of the case is resolved. But as you said, the vast majority of class members are subject to this court's order that gives us a date certain by which residents of Stateville will be out of there. And it's important, as you noted, the motion, well, this class action's been pending since 2013. It's been going over 10 years. Our motion for preliminary injunction really focused on the structural safety risks that our class members faced, primarily in the main resident unit, the courthouse, which has been in use since 1925, where concrete is actually literally falling off the walls due to deferred maintenance and degradation and deterioration of the steel, as well as the concrete and masonry. So that's really the focus of the motion. But the case has involved a number of other conditions, including water, mold, excessive heat and excessive cold, vermin, a lot of other things as well.
So Heather, obviously, prison is not supposed to be pleasant, but the court has ordered, and it's your allegation that these conditions go way beyond that and violate the Eighth Amendment. Correct? Can you explain a little bit more about what the allegations are here?
Absolutely. You're right. I mean, the state is not. First of all, I mean, you know, the prison here that we're talking about, the conditions we're talking about, are really severe. I mean, this is a 1920s building. There is no air conditioning. There is poor ventilation. When the temperatures go up in the summer and we have these hot, humid days, there is, you know, no ventilation. I mean, there's very limited ventilation, but there's no air conditioning. We're not talking about fancy conditions here. We're talking about the basic minimum, the constitutional minimum that the Eighth Amendment requires, where if the state is incarcerating individuals, and of course, you know, they're not, this is not supposed to be a fancy hotel or something like that, but it needs to meet the basic human decency for people to be held in safe, healthy conditions, not harmful conditions. I mean, we are way, you know, in our view, we're way beyond that. So this is just guaranteeing the constitutional floor, you know, the Eighth Amendment floor, that people are living in safe conditions when the state has this rule of incarcerating them.
So Heather, the proposed closure of Stateville also includes Logan Correctional Center, and the plan proposes rebuilds of both of those facilities over 5 years. Given that the officials have said that the state is far from shovel ready, what does this mean for the inmates who are being transferred out? Where are they going to be over the next few years?
Sure. And I'll answer that the best I can. I mean, obviously, the state's procurement process and process it needs to both demolish Stateville and rebuild Stateville is, you know, I can't really, you know, give, I think 5 years is probably optimistic given all of that. But because you're right, they can't do any groundbreaking work until they have the contract secured and all of that. So, but what it means is individuals, our class members, are going to be transferred to other facilities. There's a relatively close by facility at Sheridan. And, you know, in the recent past and the past couple number of years, Stateville has been used as a medium, you know, has medium security folks there. They've been running a lot of important educational programs. Some of you have heard about the ones that Northwestern University runs. There's other ones from DePaul. There's other programs for industry. So Sheridan, as opposed to Stateville, is really equipped to do some of that educational and restorative work. And so hopefully a good number of our class members will be going to Sheridan to maintain continuity with those important programs that really benefit, you know, everybody. It benefits society and it benefits our class members as well. Other individuals will be transferred to Dixon, where there are, you know, if folks have ADA concerns or other concerns. But as the, you noted in the, or you may have noticed in the order, this order gives the Department of Corrections its discretion to transfer folks. So we actually won't know and don't know where our particular class members are going until it happens, because that the court's order was sort of narrowly tailored and gave IDOC its normal discretion to transfer individuals.
Last question, Heather, is that some of the opposition to this has been from the union that says that many jobs will be displaced as a result. And as you referenced, some other opposition is that the moving of these prisoners will move them further from critical care that is necessary for many of them, that's located closer to Chicago. So how do you answer those concerns?
Yeah, those are a couple important concerns. So let me see if I can address each of those. Certainly for our class members, wherever they get transferred, if they're in need of medical certain medical care, that where they get transferred, they need to be have that continuity of care. So that's one thing. I think with respect to the concern about jobs and location of jobs, I think it's always worth noting that, you know, this location is going to be rebuilt, and it is going to be, it is not being demolished and left, you know, as an empty space. It is being committed, the state's committed the resources to rebuild it and to continue to use that. So it's true, it's a little bit of a longer perspective, but jobs are going to be back in that area in vicinity to the city where a lot of people like to work. which is understandable. With respect to the conditions, you know, from my perspective, obviously my clients are the residents there, the people being incarcerated there. But of course, you know, these same physical conditions do impact workers. And, you know, the concrete that fell off of E-House in August, actually, you know, the person who was most close proximity to that falling concrete from nearly the ceiling was a correctional officer. So from our perspective, this is actually good for workers as well. And obviously it is a transition that is a, you know, a couple over, you know, significant years, but I think the state has committed to use that same location. And so jobs will be back there for folks in the future.
But as you mentioned, with those renovations, still a long ways away. I think the governor just said that they're still in hearings right now on the proposals. So, I mean, there's definitely some distance before anything shovels hit ground, that is. Heather Lewis Donnell of Lobey & Lobey, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here.
Don't forget to listen, like, and subscribe to the Legal Face-Off podcast on social media and WGNradio.com. Well, we're all still basking in the glow of a pretty successful Summer Olympics in Paris. Jordan Childs may disagree in this moment, but maybe that's something we'll talk about a little bit later. Mo Ivory is an attorney, professor of practice, and director of Entertainment, Sports, and Media Law Initiative at Georgia State University College of Law. And she is back stateside after what we hope was a successful Summer Games for her and her class. Professor Ivory, thanks for joining us on Legal Face-Off.
Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, you teach a class at Georgia State University where you're known for bringing in celebrities to speak to your class about issues in entertainment, sports, and media law. And this year was a very special year. You were able to arrange a week-long, all-expenses-paid trip to the Olympics in Paris for your class. How did this opportunity come about?
Yeah, so about 6 years ago, I started the Center for Entertainment and Sports at Georgia State Law School. I had previously been a professor at Howard University School of Law, teaching entertainment law, and I was approached to start the program. So when I started the program and got the okay from the USG, University System of Georgia, to do the program, I was the only person involved. I taught all the classes and put the program together, and I really wanted to teach a class that I wish I would have had in law school, which was to choose something that was relevant to culture today and study it through the lens of the law. And so I came up with this concept of a course called The Legal Life Of, where every semester or every year in one of the semesters, fall or spring, I choose a celebrity and we study their entire career through the legal agreements they've signed along the way. The highlight of the class is that the celebrity comes on the last day to sit and talk with us about everything that the class has learned about them and to fill in the gaps that we need them specifically to fill in. Throughout the semester, guest speakers include all of their lawyers, agents, managers, anybody that might have been involved in a deal. So we get that on-hand experiential learning part that only people that were part of the deal can give to us. So it ends up being a great class. We've studied Ludacris, Candy Burris, Steve Harvey, Rick Ross, and it was time to dive into the world of sports. And each of those celebrities came to class. It's been a total dynamic experience. And I felt like I really needed to do sports. So I was thinking about who I would do. And, you know, many sports people came to my mind. And I even had a very popular sports person confirmed when I thought it's an Olympic year. And Atlanta was a former home of an Olympics. And so how great would it be if I could like teach about the Olympics? I knew there were many business and legal aspects of the Olympics, from bid all the way to when you get to the games and you have the court of arbitration for sport, which we all are familiar with now. But I thought it would be even unique to have like a real life experience. So obviously I couldn't bring the Olympics into the classroom on the last day like I normally do a celebrity. So I started thinking, what if I could take the class to the Olympics? So I just started digging into my contacts and figuring out how that would happen. And I actually got to the, I thought we have to get there, right? So obviously Delta Airlines. So I figured out who I would have to ask from Delta, and I put a proposal together, and literally within 48 hours, they wrote me back and they said, we'll take care of everything.
I mean, first of all, it's the greatest class in law school history. There's no question. I mean, I taught a class last year on workers' compensation 101. We took a road trip to a government workers' compensation building, for Christ's sake. That's Yours is the greatest class in history. So just explain more. So Delta picks it up. How many students are in the class? What kind of on-site subjects are you discussing while you're enjoying your time over there? That's just insane.
Yeah. So we were a contingent of 26 mixed in with a couple of professors who I needed to come with me along the way. We had a couple of students who couldn't go because the bar exam actually coincided exactly with the time of the trip. But most of the students were two L's that are rising three L's now who had taken the class. And so we started off from like the bid process. You know, what happens many, many years before an Olympics even happens and a city says, OK, we want to do a bid. All the trips that they have to take to, you know, Switzerland to speak to the IOC. What exactly is the IOC? What role do they play in the governance of Olympics? And then all of the people that play a role, the national governing bodies, which are like USA Swimming, USA Track and Field, all of those. And then everything else that they are, which are international, national, all these ways that the Olympics happen. So we spent a little bit of time doing that. And then we moved quickly into rights, right? We looked into the broadcasting agreement that is exclusive with NBC that goes to the year 2032. And we had the head general counsel of NBC Olympics come to class with the agreement, which was like this big. And he, you know, as a lawyer, you can imagine how many times that has been negotiated and renegotiated and all of that. So he really broke it down, like exactly what the rights are and how NBC and the affiliate NBC properties are really the only ones that can use the Olympic IP and broadcast live from there. And then when you go there, so the great thing about putting the trip together with that reality is that then when you go there and we got to go on to the Today Show while we were there in Paris at the Today Show Plaza, you get to see exactly what it means to own the Olympic rights. And you don't see anybody else there except NBC properties. And so you really, that comes to life for the students. So they understand that intellectual property, value while they were there in Paris. And then of course, like I couldn't have asked for anything more than for there to be a bunch of disputes going on with the arbitration, the court of arbitration while we were there, because we talked about that. We actually had a member of the Court of Arbitration for Sport come to class and talk to us about what it means to actually be at the Olympics, to have a war room for arbitration at the Olympics with people who do nothing but man the dilemmas and disputes that come out of Olympic games, whether it's from anti-doping to, you know, medal appeals, and then see it actually begin to work its way all the way up to the Court of Switzerland, which is where it's going to end up, because I do know that USA Gymnastics is going to appeal, even though Jordan has to give the bronze back. So, I mean, that I almost wish now my class wasn't over, because I just want to like go back and go look at what we're dealing with now, and like have these mock. I love to do a hypothetical of like, if she gets, you know, to the court, what would happen? Half the class take that, half the class take she prevails. It's just such great real world experience for law students to have in real time.
So, Professor, quick question. Of all the experiences that your class had, particularly in Paris, was there anything particularly shocking or surprising that that is resonating with everyone right now who is in your class?
Yeah, I mean, one of the last things that we did while we were there, which was so special, was at USA Track and Field, who was our educational partner through the class. I know the CEO and the CFO at USA Track and Field, Renee Washington, who is the COO, is a Spelman College grad, and I'm also a Spelman College grad. So I immediately reached out to her and asked if they would be my educational partner so the students could learn what a governing body does through the lens of USA Track and Field. So Edwin Moses came to class. We had a bunch of folks come to class that really lived the USA Track and Field experience. And so there in Paris, on the rooftop of a beautiful restaurant, USA Track and Field threw us a dinner. And they brought all of the people who were working for USA Track and Field at the Olympics to tell us exactly what their jobs were, how they got to be where they were, and the students got to network with them. And I really believe that a job is going to come of that dinner for somebody, because it was such a wonderful opportunity for them to see people doing all kinds of things. And then when we came back and we were watching USA Track and Field, we saw those people like giving people flowers and, you know, checking them out when they won the gold medal, helping them ring the bell. And we're like, oh my God, that was LaTanya. That was Michael. So those relationships are the relationships that create jobs in the future. And really this class is about learning the skills in order to transfer those skills into a ready-to-go job opportunity. And so that made me the happiest.
Wow. Professor, I was there also for a few days and, you know, trying not to think like a lawyer too much, but it's impossible, right? So yeah. To your point, a couple of things that impressed me from a legal perspective on the ground were, number one, the amount of security was pretty incredible. But from a legal perspective, it did not, in my opinion, interfere too much with the games. It didn't interfere with your ability to get around. Number one. Number two, there was lots of discussion leading up to the games about protests, civil rights. I didn't see any demonstrations at all, actually, but to the degree that there were some, I didn't hear any chatter about, you know, one's ability to demonstrate being hampered by security. So I thought that was handled really well. And the third thing I would say from a on the ground perspective was, the IP was really locked down. I mean, to your point, you know, I don't think I've been to any sporting event where you haven't seen stragglers on the street selling knockoff, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I live across from Wrigley Field. Right now, there's a game going on. You could see hundreds of people selling knockoff MLB products on the street right now outside that venue. I didn't see any of that in Paris, not one. So they locked down the IP pretty strongly.
They sure did. And we did security and credentialing, and there's a State Department security task force that goes with the USA team to the Olympics. And they're supposed to be completely, you know, in the shadows, and you're not supposed to notice them at all. And I gave a challenge to like all of my students, identify like one State Department security person throughout our time here, and nobody could do it. So the credentialing was tight. The security was amazing. And also we did a little exercise where I told everybody when they went to see an event, and I did it when I went to see USA basketball, to record a part of whatever the activity they were and then try to post it and see what happens. And so we were testing to see if actually the social media IP folks that said they were going to be monitoring social media were actually monitoring it. And so I took a little video of Brittany Griner at a USA basketball game. And I was like, I'm in the house with Brittany Griner, and literally 5 seconds after I posted, I got the thing. Your video has been blocked in all countries. And my students got the same thing. And I was like, see, it actually, when we talked to them about social media and how it would be monitored, they actually did what they said they were going to do.
Absolutely incredible. Thank you so much for sharing. I wish we could go on for longer, but Professor Mo Ivory, thank you for joining us on Legal Faceoff.
Absolutely. Anytime. Thank you.
Rich Lenkoff is an attorney with Downey & Lenkoff, a firm with offices in Illinois, Indiana, and Wisconsin. Rich is consistently recognized by clients like McDonald's, Target, Macy's, Wendy's, and the Chicago Bears for his zealous advocacy and outstanding litigation results. Rich's many accolades include being named as an Illinois Super Lawyer from 2015 to present and Leading Lawyer from 2012 to present. These are designations given to less than 5% of Illinois attorneys. Rich is also an active member of his community, serving on the Legal Prep Charter Academy Advisory Board and the Northern Illinois University College of Law Board of Visitors. Rich is also a producer with credits including 85, The Greatest Team in Football History, starring Barack Obama, Bill Murray, and Mike Ditka. Renegades, a Caesar's Palace production starring Terrell Owens, Jose Canseco, and Jim McMahon, Rock of Ages, and Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel in concert. In addition to hosting WGN's Legal Face-Off since 2014, Rich serves as a legal analyst for a variety of media outlets. Downey & Lenkoff is a full-service litigation firm practicing general liability, workers' compensation, professional malpractice, and intellectual property, among other practice areas. For more information about Rich and Downey & Lenkoff, please visit dl-firm.com.
Welcome back to Legal Face-Off on WGN. It's time for the Legal Grab Bag. We have the pleasure of being joined by Noah Frank, General Counsel at Sunrise Futures LLC. That's here in the Chicago area. Noah, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Michael Garden, CEO of Rejoin. He'll break you out of your corporate rut, and he does it from lovely Madison, Wisconsin. He's got a podcast. Michael, thanks for jumping on with us today.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
All right. Rich has thrown us for a curve this week on Legal Grab Bag. Usually we start with Trump Watch. Instead, he wants to start with UCLA because there's this interesting story about balancing out the pro-Palestinian demonstrations with pro-Israel demonstrations. Rich, what do you got for us?
Two stories this week. We had to drop Tina Trump Watch for the first time in maybe 2 years, but we'll be back. You know, the truth is, Ryan, that You know, there was some legal news involving Trump this week. He tried to get that judge again to recuse himself, but pretty much all Trump legal news is on hold until the election. Really, no judge is going to do anything. So we might hold on Trump for a couple episodes. But this was an interesting story, of course, one that we've covered before. Federal court judge ruled this week on Tuesday, you know, something that should be common sense, really, Tina, that UCLA cannot allow one group of students, in this case, the pro-Gaza demonstrators, to prevent another group of students, in this case, pro-Israel students, from accessing campus. Again, this is a public university. We all saw videos of UCLA, and there was a lot of protests there, lots of, you know, flat-out riots. And in one case, there was a video that was widely seen in which a student, he was a Jewish student, he was trying to cross over into campus and he was blocked from doing so. Well, he and others filed a lawsuit against UCLA, alleging that UCLA was basically preventing him from doing so. He pays tuition, and the court held this week that UCLA was wrong in doing so, that them and other universities cannot do that. They cannot, you know, and in fact, in this, you know, there was like an Israel zone, which sounds nuts that you have to, you know, encamp people on a campus. So this was the right decision. You know, we were talking off camera about the DNC that's coming to Chicago next week. There'll be lots of protests there. I think protests are a way of life going forward. I just got back from the Olympics. There was some there. But importantly, I think this ruling gives some boundaries as to what can and can't be done.
I agree, Rich. It'll be interesting to see on the DNC front. I actually have to be in the West Loop next week for a client who's coming into town, so maybe I should act as field correspondent on that. But on this UCLA issue, the judge's opinion was pretty scathing, and I think was right on point. And I do hope that as we have kids going back to school, both college campuses as well as law schools, that you know, schools are figuring this out so that we can have a much more peaceful time for our students against the backdrop of a lot of uncertainty that continues in the Middle East.
Yeah, absolutely. Mike, you're in Madison, right? There's lots of protests in Madison. There will be again as the school year begins. Yesterday, we saw the president of Columbia resigned finally after many called for her resignation in the wake of what happened at that campus. You know, the court also earlier ruled that UCLA has to basically beef up their security and create a specific plan to protect Jewish students. Again, this all seems common sense, but what's your perspective? Probably, you know, having seen a lot of this at the ground level there in Madison, where the University of Wisconsin is based.
Yeah, we're definitely exposed up here. We've had fights and riots, as you may well predict. I kind of feel like you. I mean, I don't know how we come to 2024 and really have to even have this be an issue. It seems like physical and emotional safety should sort of be paramount on campus in terms of a responsibility from the administration, and everything else should sort of fall under that. So it doesn't makes sense. And it's a little bit embarrassing, I would say, that we have to even be talking about something like this.
No question. Noah?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, these are young, impressionable kids, and, you know, you want them to find and have their voice. You know, I may have different opinions than them, but a voice is different from this, the physicality of it. And, you know, your ability to have a voice doesn't mean you can do it at any time of day or night. It doesn't mean you can be disruptive of classes. And, you know, that is what the university is there for, first and foremost, is learning. So, you know, part of it is these kids learning and growing into themselves. But the court got it right in saying your right does not allow you to, you know, impede other people's rights. So the court got it right. And I'm hopeful that, you know, we don't see this level of animosity this coming semester, but obviously we will.
No Trump this week, but we do get our Taylor Swift fix in that suspected terror plot in Europe. Rich, this one impacted you directly, right?
Unfortunately, me and 195,000 other Swifties were disappointed. I was in Vienna, ready to go to the show, I will say, with my niece. Because just a grown man going to Vienna to see Taylor Swift would be ultra Ultra creepy. But we had tickets to the first show in Vienna, and I was in Paris for the Olympics, short plane right away. And I got the news as I was boarding my flight to go to Vienna. And the legal news came out this week after teenage suspects were arrested, Tina, is that the allegation or the response from their lawyers is basically that these were kids. They were just talking. They weren't really planning on blowing up, you know, a stadium, and all the plans that were uncovered to drive a bomb in a car into the crowd and kill up to 200,000 people. That was just kids talking, right? I mean, it kind of reminds me of the Boston Marathon defense that those were kids also. I think the evidence seems pretty strong. There's investigation continues. I think that will reveal some additional conspirators. But this statement from the lawyer that this is all overblown. I mean, we see kids here in Chicago, right? You know, just wait until Sunday. We'll hear, you know, stories of 20 or 30 shootings, half of which will involve people under the age of 18. So kids are as likely to conduct this, and more than ever are being indoctrinated by some of this than grown adults. So I think it's a ridiculous statement from the lawyer.
I couldn't agree more, Rich. I mean, when you look at the consequences of the actions that they're and the acts that they're talking about doing, whether they're joking or not, they're catastrophic, right? So, and, you know, as we've seen, as you mentioned, we've seen children do some horribly destructive things with guns and otherwise. And so while, I mean, just the whole notion of asserting as a potential defense that, you know, these are kids, they were joking. I mean, someone needs to pull that out of the whatever playbook these folks are working out of, because the world we live in, it is just not going to work. That it's just inexcusable.
Yeah. Noah, how do you feel about the perspective by these suspects that, you know, they were perhaps too young to understand what they were doing? I mean, it's nonsense. Again, because we see more than ever in the world that perpetrators are younger than ever. And in terms of flat out marketing, to use, you know, the actual term, these organizations are marketing to younger and younger people to get them indoctrinated earlier and earlier on.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I have an 8-year-old and a 6.5-year-old, and they know right from wrong. And, you know, they're too small to do these types of things, but at age 17, 16, 15, I'm not exactly sure what the cutoff is in 2024, but these are kids supposedly who have the ability and the means to make better decisions, and certainly the ability and the means to actually get their hands on, you know, offensive substances. One of the lawyers admitted they had the, you know, chemicals in their apartment. That's not talk, right? That's planning and preparation. So I just think that these are kids' excuse is a garbage defense at this point. I mean, you know, these are just kids. That's an excuse when you don't invite somebody to the movies. That's not an excuse for planning to murder people en masse.
Moving along, a 3-time WNBA All-Star is suing the league and her former team over the way she says she was treated when she got pregnant. Tina, fill us in on this story.
So, Ryan, earlier this week, Derica Hamby filed a discrimination and unlawful retaliation lawsuit against the league and her former team, the Las Vegas Aces, accusing the team of treating her fairly because she was pregnant and alleging repeated acts of intimidation, discrimination, and retaliation, which she says not only resulted in her being treated differently by the Aces staff, but that it also contributed to her subsequent trade to the Los Angeles Sparks. The lawsuit seeks unspecified compensatory and punitive damages, and the WNBA has said that it is currently reviewing the complaint. Hamby first accused the Las Vegas Aces of wrongdoing shortly after she was traded in January of 2023. She took to social media. She claimed that she had discovered she was pregnant in mid-July of 2022, right before she signed her 2-year extension with the Aces. And then she had subsequently told her head coach, Becky Hammon, and other team staff about the pregnancy shortly thereafter. She had kept playing, won the championship with the Aces in September of 2022, and a couple days later, During a public celebration, she announced that she was expecting. Hamby alleges that in January of 2023, she was told by her coach that she was a question mark for the season and that the Aces needed bodies to play. She also claims that Hammond had accused her of signing her extension knowing she was pregnant. Hamby denied it, said that she would give birth and it would be during the off season and that she'd be fully ready to go right at the start of the preseason. It was during that call that Hamby then learned that she was being traded. Hammond denied it, said that her pregnancy did not trigger the trade, that the team needed three players and were able to get them for Hamby's one single contract. The WNBA apparently investigated her claims after Hamby filed the complaint in January 2023 and later suspended Hammond for two games for violating league and team workplace policies. The WNBA also stripped the Aces of their 2025 first round draft pick, apparently for impermissible benefits in connection with Hamby's contract. Hamby went on that season to report to Sparks training camp, played a full season, and she just won the bronze medal at the Olympics as a member of the U.S. women's basketball team. And in June, she has signed an extension with the Sparks, keeping her with the Sparks until 2025. So, I mean, Rich, clearly a lot of eyes on this case. It's important given the increasing popularity of the WNBA, and women are entitled to have families just like everybody else.
True. I want to bring Noah and Mike after Noah in on this because, you know, Noah, while employed by my law firm, I know to be an excellent employment lawyer. But I mean, it's a little more complex because there's a couple things at play here. There's a anytime you're dealing with athletes, you got to look at the collective bargaining agreement because that could supersede or at least be a factor in this issue. The CBA prohibits a player from entering into a contract while knowing she is pregnant without prior written disclosure to the team. So it's unclear as to what degree they, you know, this will come into play, the CBA. Also, Noah, and you know this better than I do, you know, Congress amended the Title VII in 2022 to require employers to make reasonable accommodations for pregnant employees. That didn't take effect, though, until June 23, and the dates in this lawsuit are not applicable. So there's a couple of things involved here. It's a little bit complex, but ultimately, you would imagine a high-profile player and a team would want to resolve this, but there's a couple issues involved here as well.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting case, especially as you brought up, you got union issues, you got Title VII. Frankly, I think that the collective bargaining agreement is suspect, that provision, period. I don't see that holding up, period. It's sort of, you know, like waiving other rights. You just can't, right? They can't waive their right to have protected leave otherwise. You know, professional sports sometimes with you know, the antitrust rules, maybe they can get around it. But you know, certainly it looks like the league took steps to you know, take some punitive action against the coach and against the team. So sounds like they at least tried to do something. But it's kind of one of those weird situations where they're saying nothing happened, you know, not even an apology to the player, but yet they did something punitive, right? They didn't just suspend the coach. They also took away a draft pick. So I'm really excited to see how this case goes down. You know, unfortunately for the public, 99% of these things all end in a settlement and we won't see what happens. But
what's also interesting, Mike, is, you know, putting aside whether the team is liable and whether this player will be able to prove liability. We always explain to our listeners and viewers that these cases have two issues, right? Liability and damages. The question is, in this case, if they could prove liability, what are her damages? I mean, by all accounts, from what I read, she was paid the same by her new team than her prior team. So she's trying to prove something like emotional distress. You know, those are claims that are really hard to prove. As someone who defends those kind of cases all the time, really hard to prove that you really suffered any damages as a result of this emotional distress. But what are your thoughts? Any legs, any damages allegations?
I thought this was really interesting as well. And I know nothing about the intricacies of the law here as with this, but from a cultural standpoint, it's just really interesting. It seems like everything was copacetic and something did happen. So it feels like there's some smoke and fire in terms of the relationship there. I don't see how you have damages. I guess just because she went on to play, all of that was completely fine. I think this speaks more to the WNBA overall and how they got to get their stuff together. I mean, I feel like this is an issue they could really come together around somehow and make a statement and show the world that like women in the WNBA are united here. And it just seems like a little bit more bickering headlines, unfortunately, that have kind of plagued the league recently.
And there have never been more eyeballs on the WNBA than there are this season, yeah. That's for sure. All right, well, going back to the Olympics, a women's boxing gold medalist is now suing some pretty famous people in a cyberbullying lawsuit. I don't know if you guys know this, but Rich went to the Olympics. Rich, did you happen to catch any women's boxing?
I did not. I saw men's boxing, actually. I saw women's beach volleyball, which was incredible. But yeah, this it's both a lawsuit and they opened a criminal investigation in France over this alleged cyberbullying. This was obviously well covered. This boxer named Khalif won the gold medal. And there was lots of chatter online, specifically in this case, as alleged by the lawsuit by Elon Musk and J.K. Rowling, famous writer of the Harry Potter books, she said was cyberbullying, and there are laws preventing that in France. Now, there's some question about whether the alleged cyberbullying has to happen on French soil or not for it to be actionable. But, you know, this person was, again, there was lots of chatter online about whether she should be competing because of her gender. It's interesting that she has pursued this so quickly. So we'll see if it has any merit, but, you know, she's responded that she's a woman like any other woman. The pushback, Tina, was that she was born a man, that she shouldn't be competing in women's boxing at all. And some, like these two defendants, were very vocal about that.
Well, you know, Rich, I mean, my understanding is that whole issue had been looked at before the competition and that the decision was that she could compete. And so, putting that aside for the moment, I'm happy to see this lawsuit because as we've covered on this show, particularly over the last 12 to 18 months, there are increased incidents of cyberbullying. And, you know, the law sometimes doesn't evolve as quickly as the activities that people engage in. And I do think that whether there's ultimate merit to this or not, I do think it's important that people are using what aspects of the law are available to them, especially if they have a colorable claim that people are engaging in activity like cyberbullying. So, I mean, we've covered how cyberbullying has led to people committing suicide and other terrible things. And so I do think it's something that we can need to continue to keep an eye on and laws need to continue to be promulgated to address these things.
Yeah, well stated, Mike. Other high-profile potential defendants or litigants include Logan Paul, who said that this was an example of the purest form of evil unfolding right before our eyes. A man was allowed to beat up a woman. Also, none other than back to Trump Watch, Ryan and Mike. Trump tweeted that when he is president, he will keep men out of women's sports. So is this an expression of free speech or is this cyberbullying?
To me, there's a issue of like, is it directed at the person versus the issue at large? So I think cyberbullying is a real thing. I know nothing about the whether or not some of these tweets, meet the bar for what or the definition for what cyberbullying actually is. And I think that's really an important thing here because people do need to be allowed to voice an opinion on the issue and try to separate that out from the individual person. To make sure that that person still feels, you know, not attacked and safe, I guess. That's how I look at it.
Yeah, Noah, Logan Paul deleted the tweet and issued an apology. But as we all know from defamation cases, you know, the one-time utterance is enough.
Yeah. You know, first of all, I want to say the IOC got its decision spot on, especially in boxing where it's based on weight class. you know, you put a 150-pound muscular woman against a 150-pound muscular man, I'm going to say fair fight, right? So them saying this is a woman, she's fighting women, I support the IOC. I'm not so sure about cyberbullying for a public figure. If this was a, you know, purely amateur college kid and people started picking on her, I think I might feel differently. But here you have somebody who's in the public limelight. You know, I think that I just feel like when you're a public figure, you know, people can fairly pick on Elon Musk too. So I'm not sure how I feel about this going forward as a cyberbullying case in this instance.
I think it's a really good point. Sorry to cut you off, but it's a really good point, and it ties into our earlier discussion of damages. In many ways, you could argue that this individual would not be as well known as she is today, or as they are today. She is, I think she calls herself, she uses that pronoun. Hey. I think she would not be as well known. We wouldn't be talking about her, but for this cyberbullying. So in some respects, you know, and she probably will, you know, get some endorsement deals out of it. So I think your point is well taken. If you look right now, if any of us go on X right now and type in any well-known athlete, there will be an equal number of people insulting them, probably way more than giving them, you know, flowers. So I think I think you're right. No, it's part of the deal. Whether that crosses into the, you know, level of cyberbullying, I think it's a little tough to prove. So I think you're right on that.
And just a little bit of background on that. This Algerian boxer was actually banned by the World Boxing Body because she had an XY chromosome and increased testosterone, did compete in the Tokyo Games, did not medal there. But during these games, one of her competitors actually bowed out because couldn't take it anymore, said she was boxing against a man and didn't want to do it. But and by the way, she just released a photo of a complete makeover she's had since the Olympics. So go ahead and check out the internet for that. All right. Being Kanye West, or I guess we call him Ye West's lawyers, apparently no laughing matter. Tina, what's going on with our favorite Chicago rapper?
What's going on is laughing gas, apparently. Believe it or not, listeners, Ye is again in the news with yet another falling out with his lawyers. We had covered a falling out he had with his lawyers recently here on LFO. This time, the lawyer involved is claiming that it has to do with Ye's alleged laughing gas addiction. Earlier this week, news broke that a Los Angeles judge signed off on Kanye West's lawyer, Brian Broomfield, dropping him as a client amidst allegations of nitrous oxide abuse. Broomfield had been representing Ye in a $2 million lawsuit involving his former business partners at The Gap and in a couple of other ongoing cases. In addition to the issues relating to Ye's alleged laughing gas addiction, he also stopped talking to his lawyer, didn't pay his lawyer either, which never has a good making for a good relationship. All kidding aside, in a more sobering part of this story, and we're going to be covering a couple of other stories like this during the show, Ye's former chief of staff has made serious allegations to the California Dental Board, accusing Ye's dentist, Thomas Connolly, of being Ye's source for the nitrous oxide. His chief of staff claims that Ye's behavior has become completely erratic and that Ye talks about nitrous oxide constantly and that he's become increasingly hard to work with and claims that he has erratic mood swings, which are all bases for what his chief of staff claims to be his addiction to nitrous oxide. He also claims that Connolly was apparently paid $50,000 a month by Ye for the nitrous oxide. Connolly vehemently denies these allegations, says he's not guilty of any wrongdoing, and that Ye's chief of staff's claims are intentionally misleading, and no comment from Ye on any of these allegations, Rich.
I mean, this dentist is a proponent of recreational use of nitrous oxide. Doesn't matter. It's illegal, right? So he should be prosecuted, just like the doctor who we are about to cover in our very story is being prosecuted. I mean, this trend of doctors giving drugs to celebrities and ripping them off at that is nutty and should be prosecuted. Mike, what's your take on this one?
Yeah, absolutely. It's unfortunately very, very sad to see the sort of downfall of someone like this. I think of obviously Michael Jackson as well. The question I have, which just as a casual observer, is with the chief of staff kind of blowing the whistle, does that person open themselves up to any legal action for standing by or witnessing? How does that work?
I think they probably have some whistleblower protection for that. But yeah, I mean, certainly if they were aware of this happening and it's criminal behavior, or even, you know, there's some civil lawsuit, then sure, they would be brought in as well. I think it's a good point.
All right, moving along, another story about an alleged celebrity addiction. Charges were filed this week in the death of Matthew Perry. Rich, this all centers around the use of ketamine, a drug that we've heard more frequently about in recent years.
Now, ketamine is on its own a drug that is commonly used to treat a variety of ailments, including depression, and generally doesn't lead to overdoses. But this week, yesterday, there was a unsealing of an indictment against four individuals who allegedly, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office in L.A., conspired to lead to the overdose death of Matthew Perry. Among those charged, Tina, was his longtime assistant who allegedly administered the last dose of this drug, ketamine, that ultimately led to his death in the hot tub on that day. It has been widely recovered or widely covered. Another named defendant is the so-called ketamine queen of Los Angeles, who was involved in distributing this drug. And also, unfortunately, as we just talked about, his doctor, who not only was procuring this drug, but there's a text that the U.S. attorney revealed yesterday that talks about basically ripping Matthew Perry off. They said words to the effect of, "Let's see how much we could charge this moron." Those are the exact words. And let's find out, right? And they were overcharging him by an incredible amount. So obviously the idea that you are taking advantage of a well-known addict like Matthew Perry and supplying him with these drugs and overcharging him, obviously it's just very difficult to understand. I'm glad that they are going after these people. Again, it's a very long complaint, and the allegation is that this conspiracy was going on for a while. So I think it's a good move. There is some question about whether it was, you know, this ketamine was the causative factor of his death. All I have to prove is that it was a factor. He had some other contributing factors, but sounds like it's a pretty strong indictment.
Now, Rich, I mean, it's extraordinarily tragic. We could spend a whole show just talking about the ins and outs here, because different media outlets have different levels of detail. But just number one, the horrible judgment and intent around becoming essentially his dealer, and the text verbiage about, you know, calling him a moron, let's overcharge him. I mean, they completely knew they had the mens rea here. They knew exactly what they were doing. They knew they were dealing with an addict. They knew that he was addicted to this. And when you hear just the level of detail on some of these stories about like the 24 hours leading up to his death and how much his personal assistant was injecting him with the ketamine, it's hard to believe that it did not have a meaningful, that it wasn't a meaningful cause in his ultimate death. I just find it hard to believe. I mean, I do understand that there may have been some other underlying health issues too, probably by virtue of his long-term drug addiction. That being said, at least if we can take as true some of what we're hearing about like the last 24 hours, last week of his life, it's a pretty gruesome story.
Yeah, Noah, you know, Mike mentioned earlier the Michael Jackson death, the doctor who supplied him those drugs also served some time. I think the most famous or earliest example of this was John Belushi. When he died, there was a she pled guilty to supply his girlfriend's and drug dealer pled guilty to supplying with drugs. You know, there are closing arguments this week in Santa Fe for some for the parents of a high school shooter. So increasingly, the idea is that not only the perpetrator of an act is responsible, but those surrounding that person, enabling them and perhaps providing them with the means by which to commit a crime, are also responsible. What are your feelings about that?
So first of all, I can't even get cough medicine at the pharmacy without showing my ID, right? And the thing about this that saddens me so greatly is that this isn't a third-party drug dealer. This is a person with a heightened duty. They have a fiduciary duty to their patient. You know, this is somebody that we trust to take care of us. The doctor should not have been helping him overdose. The doctor should have been helping him get treatment that he needed. Just everything about it is just a violation of trust. And you hear things like this and it makes you wonder, you know, who else is trying to get you, especially when you've given that person a level of trust, right? The you know, his assistant, you could equate to a babysitter, right? When I go out and I leave my kids with a babysitter, I'm trusting that person to do what is right for my kids. Sure, let them have a little bit of extra dessert. That doesn't mean have five desserts when I'm out, because why not, right? And I think that's really the problem here, is the doctor looked at this and said, you know, well, I'll give him as much dessert as he wants, and the parents are going to pay me for it anyway. And it's just such a abhorrent violation of trust.
Yeah, well stated, Mike.
Yeah, I have three young kids. I was part of opening up an opioid addiction clinic here in Madison, Wisconsin. I know a little bit about addiction from a distance, and just seeing how it can infiltrate areas. I love the idea. I just think this is what the justice system is for. Go after these types of things. And I'm excited about the trickle down effect and maybe how that trickles down to the kids and some of the people that are in smaller communities who are turning to these types of drugs. Hopefully it's going to cut off some of the supply. I don't know about that, but this is the type of message I think we need to send and make it difficult. Because this is a terrible, terrible, these addictions are absolutely horrible. They ruin marriages, families, and communities. And so I'm glad to see some work going into this.
All right, last item in the grab bag, smuggling drugs and cell phones into prison is not something you should be doing, Tina, especially if you're a lawyer. I'm not accusing you, by the way, of doing that, but just saying in general.
We met. That was back to the origins of legal face-off.
So guys, yes, ending on a, I don't know, lighter note, perhaps. I'm not sure. Maybe our listeners should decide. Daniel Sidney Dale of Terry, Mississippi, was recently charged with 2 counts of conspiracy and 3 counts of introducing contraband into a jail. He was arrested after a video showed him allegedly giving contraband to an inmate. He brought into the facility 2 cell phones, 2 cell phone charger blocks, a digital scale, cigarettes, and a substance thought to be marijuana. He apparently was conspiring with 2 inmates and was arrested after a video showed him giving the contraband to the inmate. Apparently, he was posing as a legal counsel during the visit. And the question is whether or not he had also passed contraband to other inmates, because apparently this guy had 10 other visits that he had made to the facility since June. What I find really strange, Rich, is that no one caught on that this guy kept showing up, and he's not really the most handsome of gents, but he's now being held on a $75,000 bond.
Well, handsome is in the eye of the beholder, right? And take a look at this fine fellow. Whoa!
Love it.
Wow. That he did not flag anything for anybody at the prison coming in. What a shocker.
Mostly he sees Matthew Perry's doctor.
Yeah, oh, exactly.
Wow. This guy, yeah, I would not let him anywhere near a prison unless he was going in. But yeah, I mean, not a great shot. He does say smuggler all over. He reeks of smuggler, in my opinion. All right. Well, as we wrap up, everyone, we'd like to take advantage of our new friends and learn a little bit something. This is our Olympic episode, I guess, right? So why don't we go around the horn and everyone tell us your favorite Olympian of all time. Ryan Burrow, you are Mr. Olympics.
Gosh.
Don't look all confused and taken aback. You must have a favorite Olympian of all time.
Favorite Olympian of all time. I did like Pommel Horse Steve. I think he worked into the top five. I'll have to go back to the dream team and say MJ. I know that's the easy one, but that team was phenomenal.
Dream team. Noah, favorite Olympian?
I still think Tanya.
Oh, not an Olympian, though.
No, she never made it.
Something got in her way, I believe.
What, 12-inch iron pipe?
She was an Olympian. I think you're right. I think she did make it, right?
She was.
I think,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she took the spot.
Yeah, you're right. All right, good call. Mike. Now,
Mike, I think Rich is trying to signal to you countries you can look at besides the United States. So right. There are correct answers here.
Right. I'm getting it loud and clear from Rich. My favorite has got to be Michael Johnson, because I was at an amazing age when he broke that record, and I can still remember all of that. But I do have a second, because he just creeped in. It is my middle son's favorite basketball player, Steph Curry,
oh,
who had an amazing run this year, and we were watching it and absolutely going nuts as he just took over the Olympics kind of late in their run. So
that Devil Curry, I don't know if you saw that in the French broadcast, that Devil Curry.
Oui, oui.
I got a chance to see him in person this year with my son, and we sat actually like courtside for his warm up. It was unbelievable. It was amazing. So I got a special place in my heart for the chef.
By the way, Michael Johnson, also known as one of the Celebrity Apprentice contestants, yes, fired by Donald Trump. Let's see, Tina, favorite Olympian of all time.
Very tough, but I have to sort of go back to my youth, our youth, Rich, Mary Lou Retton. Loved her.
Diminutive gold medalist, star of the Wheaties box. Excellent. Lisa, any favorite Olympians?
I like Michael Phelps.
Oh, wow. That's a good one.
Is he going to light the cauldron, you think, in LA? You think he's going to be the one, or is it going to be Simone?
I think it's Jordan. I think it's MJ.
Or LeBron, I suppose, in LA.
So being Canadian, my favorite is a guy named Donovan Bailey, who for a short period was the fastest man alive. But I'll also give you my American answer. Hold on. This is the official. I did volunteer for Team USA this year, so I'll give you the official. There we go. My favorite American, because I saw him, was Bruce Jenner, now known as Caitlyn Jenner, but back in 1976, not to date myself, I was at those Olympics in Montreal, my hometown, and saw Bruce Jenner win the decathlon, which, for those of you who remember, was for a long time was known as the best athlete in the world. The winner of the decathlon was always the best athlete in the world. Now it's not so known, but Bruce Jenner was incredible.
All right. Do you want to put a bow on this one? Should we wrap it up? Do you have any, like... Any national anthems you would like to play?
Let's
wrap this up here. No.
With Ukraine's national anthem. Hang on. Let me see that for a second.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Michael Garden and Noah Frank. That'll do it for this latest installment of Legal Face-Off on WGN. Special thanks to Professor Mo Ivory from Georgia State University, who was at the Olympics, Professor Bertrall Ross of University of Virginia, and attorney Heather Lewis Donnell of Lovey and Lovey. Also shouts out to Ben Anderson, Lisa Stegall. For Tina Martini, Rich Lenkoff, who went to the Olympics, I'm Ryan Burrow. Thanks again for joining us on Legal Face-Off on WGN.
It's Christina Martini and Rich Lenkoff. You know what time it is. Welcome to Legal Face-Off. Two lawyers trading jab for jab. So hit them up with any questions you have. WGN Radio, we blowing up your stereo. Got a question, just pick up the phone and they'll let you know. Covering sports, Hollywood, and don't forget...